I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. This week, we talked to editorial page editor Paul Schwanier about the lack of a budget in Connecticut, President Trump's latest dust-up with the media, and his administration's request for voter records from all 50 states. A few things to discuss this week in the news. Let's start with the state's budget, or lack of budget, as the fiscal year started. How did we get here, and what exactly does it mean that Governor Malloy is running the state budget under executive order?
Well, we got here because the legislature adjourned June 7th, which is the by constitution the end of their official session in odd years. In odd years, their main function is to enact a two-year spending plan, and then they come back in the even years and adjust it as necessary depending on how things are going. So they failed in that primary mission. There was some hope that perhaps they could come back before the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, and do what they hadn't done during the regular session, but they were unable to do that. Politically, the primary reason seems to be we have much more divided government than we've seen in a long time in Connecticut. The state Senate is evenly split 18 to 18, which would leave a tie-breaking vote, and that's been seen several times by the lieutenant governor, which is the Democrats control the governorship. And in the House, it's only 79-72 Democratic advantage. But among a lot of those Democrats, quite a few fiscal moderates wouldn't be shocking to see them at times vote for Republicans. So in the past, the Democrats in recent years have had big majorities, and they've been able to work out their budget decisions, difficult as they might have been, in caucus, and then bring them to the floor and approve them. And they would sometimes lose a few votes, and the House leadership, for instance, would tell some of these moderate Democrats, okay, you know, we know you're in a conservative district, you can vote against the budget, we have enough votes.
Right.
They can't do that now.
Right.
So there has to be some manner to achieve, to some degree, a bipartisan approach, and that has continued to elude the legislature even as we get into the fiscal year.
Where's the big disagreement?
The big disagreement seems to be on taxes, particularly on the House Democratic Caucus. They've proposed an increase of the sales tax, which is now 6.35 up to 6.99.
Not quite 7.
Not quite 7. You know, all the commercials you see that they're going to sell you this magical item for $19.99 because you don't want to pay 20. So apparently we're all supposed to be happy because we weren't going to get 7%.
Yeah, I think there's some kind of psychological thing to that, yes.
I guess in some way, but I think in another way it just puts a big bright light on it.
Right,
it's so transparently silly to put it at 6.99 and probably makes all the math more difficult for all those accountants.
I will say, if I can interrupt, we were in California, Southern California, recently, and the sales tax down there is almost 10% in Southern California, just as a comparison.
Right, which is, you know, making any fiscal conservative listening to this podcast cringe
right.
Such.
Yeah.
So that's one disagreement, and the Democrats in the House seem to be somewhat out on a limb on this. The Governor Malloy, a Democrat, has said they have to lead with spending cuts. He has seen some big companies leave the state. He's trying to grow the economy here, and he feels tax increases, leading with tax increases, is not a good idea. So both the governor and the Senate seem to be looking for ways more spending cuts to try to solve the problem. So that seems to be the big impasse is revenue versus spending cuts.
You mentioned businesses leaving. Aetna just announced that they'll be leaving Connecticut.
Well, their headquarters is being moved as of now, at least. A lot of their rank and file workforce, the clerical people, actuaries, many of them will continue to work in the Hartford area. but the executive offices are moving to Manhattan, which sort of symbolic to one of the big issues that's hit Connecticut is a lot of the upper level, higher income people are not staying in the state. It's one reason we've seen real big shortfalls in tax revenues is some of these high income taxpayers have gone elsewhere. The idea that you lived in Fairfield County and made your money in New York City, the billionaires aren't quite tied to that anymore. You can, you know, in the digital age, you can live anywhere and do your investments and handle your hedge funds and such. Right. So that dynamic, that attractiveness living in Fairfield County, kind of a new generation isn't so taken with that. So, you know, seeing at the headquarters move, those are the higher level jobs, sort of very apropos to the one of the problems that Connecticut has faced.
The governor, under executive orders, is handling the budget currently. What does that mean for the state, and what can we look forward to in the next few weeks?
Well, he knows the Office of Fiscal Analysis and his own budget bean counters have told him that if nothing changes, if we collect the money we expect to collect and we spend the money that the prior budget was spending at that level, that in 2 years we're $5 billion out of whack. So he knows he cannot just keep spending money and collecting money as he did on the prior budget. He has to begin controlling spending so this deficit doesn't grow larger. And he has no authority to raise revenue as governor. All he can do is cut spending largely. He can maybe move money around from one account to another. So, you know, the upshot of that is there's less priority setting. The legislature has the purse strings. It can kind of pick and choose more carefully where it wants to control spending, how it's going to do it. There's less logic to it when the governor just has to do by cutting the. One big example of that is the governor proposed a temporary budget to try to buy some time, which he couldn't get through the House for 3 months, and it held up raises for judges. Judges were scheduled for a raise. It was set to go into effect. Only the legislature could change that. Because the legislature didn't act, those raises have gone through. Right. So you have judges getting raises and programs for people with disabilities being cut, which kind of doesn't make a lot of sense in any world, but that's sort of what we're left with without a working budget.
What cuts has he proposed to make under this executive order?
Yeah, he's sort of done largely across the board proportional cuts to different programs to the money he feels he has to save to try to keep things as much as he can in balance till the legislature does its job and gives him a budget. So the thing is, you know, a 5% cut, as we've seen in Department of Transportation, it's a big agency. They spend their money throughout the year. They can put off projects. They kind of deal with it more adroitly than some small social services program that's running a group home where they pretty much spend all they get month to month to provide the services, and they get a 5 or 10% cut. It's much more difficult for them, and they feel the impact more so.
So what's next?
The House leadership, Democratic House leadership, say they'll be back July 18th. By then, we'll know whether the state labor unions have ratified a budget concession deal that the governor worked out with them that would save the state $1.5 billion towards that $5 billion deficit they have to make up over the next 2 years in return for extending their contract on benefits and retirement through 2027. It would expire in 2022. That was the trade-off on that. So by July 18th, when the House says they will return, we'll know whether or not the state has those savings, which would also have to be approved by the legislature. The Speaker of the House said he feels he has the votes to get his sales tax through and the budget they're proposing through. As a political observer, I'm very skeptical of that. I don't know that he has enough votes. I don't think he'll have any Republican votes, and I don't know if he can hold his caucus together on that. Meanwhile, the Senate leaders have been working and negotiating quietly, looking at their two budgets. If we're going to solve this thing, I think most likely, in my mind, sort of a compromise budget comes out of the Senate side. And there may be both Republicans and Democrats voting against it, but enough voting for it that it passes. And then that's thrust upon the House. And again, you might see a sort of bipartisan group willing to bite the bullet and approve it. But it's anybody's guess if that can happen, when that can happen. Really an uncharted territory, at least for Connecticut, with this kind of extended budget impasse.
And in the meantime, Connecticut's not alone. It looks like there's about 9 other states that welcomed a new fiscal year without a budget in place, including Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island. Not alone.
That might make Governor Malloy feel better.
Yeah.
That he's not alone and unable to get a budget completed. That being said, not a lot of excuses. I think they had months and months, and probably in those other states as well, to figure out how they're going to do this. And they always seem to wait to the last minute to do so, and in this time, beyond.
What does Leave Work Now mean to you? What does it imply?
It implies that wherever you're sitting listening to this, it is not as fun as what you could be doing.
Exactly. We're the harbingers of relaxation.
It's your job every day to go and do what other people would consider fun. So this podcast is sort of like going along with you.
You want to go with me the next time I attend a Yanni concert?
Leave Work Now with Rick Costner. Find us on theday.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
In the last week or two, Trump has continued his combative relationship with journalists and people in the media. Most recently, he tweeted out a meme, a little GIF of himself back in his professional wrestling days when he used to make appearances. Somebody created a meme of him beating an individual with the face of CNN, the CNN logo superimposed on the face. How do you think this affects the country's climate of divisiveness? I mean, this can't possibly help.
Well, first off, a few years ago, if I had been watching a made-for-TV movie about some future president,
right.
Who, and it reached the point in the movie where he tweets out a video of his former wrestling days beating someone up, I'd probably say that's probably where I flipped it off and
right.
say this thing is totally unrealistic.
Right.
As bad as we are, I don't think we'd ever like have a situation
right.
like that. But here we are. You can sort of laugh it off. It is, but the man is president.
And some people have said, you know, it's a joke. You know, you can't take it seriously. But you know, he is the president.
I think if this was the only thing he did, if he had a little dust up with CNN and he put those video yeah. out, but I think that you have to put it in the context of what he's been saying. He has a line now at every time he has a rally, and it's sort of odd that he's still having rallies. He's now president. He's not running anymore. There's not another election for 3.5 years, but. But there's always a line at these rallies about the media, and he picks out a couple examples, and the crowd jeers. He's referenced the media generally, news coverage, as the enemy of the people,
right.
which is, I just think that it's really unhealthy in a democracy because essentially if you boil that down to what he's asking, people who support him are, you cannot believe anything you hear that is critical of me, that questions my policies, it's all, if it's against me, don't believe it. It's fake news. Only trust what I say and what news organizations that back me say. And that's just un-American.
Right.
I mean, that's the kind of thing you see, you know, in strongman totalitarian type states. You don't see it in the United States. Now, we have thick skins in the media. We're open to criticism. I think there's something to be said that media generally tends to lean to the left in coverage. There's been studies of that. But it's a long way from that and fair criticism and back and forth to calling the press the enemy of the people. Right. I just don't think that's good. And I think all we can do in the media is, one, continue to do our jobs and try not to be colored by that. Try, right. You know, we're adversary in that we should look at everyone critically, but you know, we got to be careful not to at all change our coverage because we're unhappy with the criticism we're facing. If I was advising the president, I think his better option is to focus very much on his agenda, get some of the things, he's relied on executive order, not much legislatively, get some of the health care reform that he said would be a better system, expand it to more people. We haven't seen that at all. If he could focus on getting that done, tax reform, which was infrastructure, you know, make the press write about those things. You know, focus on getting your job done. I think that's a better approach than simply constantly fighting over the latest slight that he's felt he's received.
And I think that's something that we've heard before, where, you know, whenever there's been a new kind of social media dust up involving Trump, the same question is, why isn't he, you know, the president focusing on these other issues? So, I mean, and he has advisors, but, you know, are they controlling his Twitter habit? I'm not sure that they are.
Yeah, apparently not. Yeah. When he addressed Congress shortly after the election, he said something to the effect, the time for trivial matters is over. And we had an editorial the next day saying, amen, you know, let's end these, you know, tweets about, what some celebrity might have said about you.
Right.
Who cares? You're president. But unfortunately, I guess he had a different version of what's trivial.
And now he's back in Europe, his second foreign trip as president. So we'll see how he does. He's going to the G20 meeting. We'll see. We'll see what comes of it.
It's been some criticism of Russia in a speech. We're talking on Thursday, July 6th, and he spoke this morning in Europe. He raised some concern about Russian meddling in the Ukraine. He reemphasized the U.S. support for NATO and collectively defending one another. So. He said some of the right things that I think should be said that weren't emphasized during his last trip to Europe.
And he's meeting with Putin.
Yes, and everyone's going to be eager how much we get out of that.
So more to see from President Trump.
Hey, it's the Sports Doctor, Keith P. O'Brien. If you want a different take, if you want a different angle, a different way to view sports, well, check out my weekly podcast, and I will show you the way from a fan's standpoint. We'll bring you great guests, local, national, athletes, coaches, players, you name it. I'll bring it to you. Sports Doctor Podcast, right here on theday.com.
The Trump administration has also formed a voter fraud commission, and they have made requests of all 50 states asking for public voting records, which include names, addresses, date of birth, party affiliation, last four digits of the Social Security number, and recent voting history in an attempt to investigate allegations of voter fraud, which President Trump has made on numerous occasions. I think he's claimed that 3 to 5 million undocumented immigrants voted in the 2016 election, although there hasn't been any evidence to back that up. And some states are complying. It looks like a total of 6 states are fully complying. And the rest are either partially complying or denying the request. What do you make of this, Paul?
Well, the origin of this investigation is basically President Trump's ego, that he was not enough apparently to win the presidency. He seems offended by the fact that his opponent got more popular votes, so in his mind and seemingly nowhere else became this idea, well, those must have been millions of votes cast by people who were here illegally or for some other reason didn't have the right to vote. Otherwise, how could he possibly have not won the popular vote? As you noted, every objective study that has looked at this said the instances of voter fraud are extremely small.
Right, negligible. Right,
not going to influence an election, certainly not going to influence a national election. So it's kind of a waste of time. I think a lot of secretaries of state, particularly Democratic ones, see it's really an investigation of the guise of some effort to try to dissuade some groups from voting, which we've seen in some states with identification laws and other issues, making certain demographic groups that tend to trend Democratic not vote, which might be the motivation behind it. You know, as for the state's response, I know Connecticut is among those states. It's a question whether they want to turn over these documents. I think the state's obligated to provide whatever is public under freedom of information laws in their respective states and no more. I don't think really the federal government, unless they can come in and say, we as a federal matter feel that federal laws are being violated in this specific manner, right, and therefore we need this information, that just having a fishing expedition where they're just looking for something, not knowing what's there and just asking for all information, I think it's really a violation of states' rights, and I don't think the state should be obligated to turn over anything other than what their own laws say is public, and you know, anyone could go in and ask for and get.
Right. And I think some states are saying that the request would violate some of their own state privacy laws. And the Secretary of State for Connecticut, Denise Merrill, said that, you know, that she's wary of the intent, especially with Kansas State Secretary of State Kris Kobach's who leads the commission, and she said, quote, he has a lengthy record of illegally disenfranchising eligible voters in Kansas, which I think probably relates to some of the voter ID laws that various states have tried to pass.
And interestingly, some of the strongest critics of providing information to some Republican governors, conservative states, because they see it as, again, a states' rights issue.
An overreach by the federal government.
The federal government coming in and reaching its long arm into some state and saying, we want to, you know, see all these records. And I think Mississippi, I believe, is one of those who got a real pushback and said, the heck with that. You know, that's, we're under no obligation. So, again, I think it's another, you know, as we go, you know, back, look at the ban on several Muslim countries from people entering from those countries. It didn't seem well designed and thought out. It's still working its way through the courts. The Supreme Court has allowed some of it to go through a pending review. But this one, the same. It seems like it was not terribly thought out in the implications. And, you know, if it ends up in court, I think they're going to have a tough case to make to, you know, overcome states' rights with this conservative Supreme Court.
Something else to follow in the news cycle. Maybe a an editorial regarding Connecticut's compliance?
It could be by the time this is on the air. We may have one. It used to be a time I'd look forward to summer because it would slow down a little. Those days don't seem to happen anymore.
No. Keeps us busy.
Well, that's true.
All right. Well, thank you.